You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter in a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. And Don, it's going to be 97 today. And my husband says that's cool.
Yes, that is going to be the coolest day of the next 7 days or so, according to the National Weather Service. We have a epic, record-breaking weather event about to occur here in the Sacramento Valley, and in fact, all of the western states. This high-pressure dome is settling in over Nevada, and today, the day Lois and I are recording the show, it's only going to be 97 degrees Wednesday, and tonight will be 58 degrees. Well, enjoy that while you can. So the day of the broadcast will be 103 degrees. Now, these have gone up and down as they've tried to discern exactly how far out to the west this dome is going to go. Is it going to literally park all the way over the Bay Area and affect temperatures in San Francisco and places like that? Or is it going to, as most of them have done this summer, stop a little short of where we are, and we might not be as high as some of these numbers? But you know what? Don't get your hopes up, because listen to these numbers. Thursday, day of the broadcast, 103 degrees. Thursday night, cooling to 63 degrees. Friday, 101. Friday night, also 63. Saturday, an excessive heat warning is in effect. Saturday will be 106, according to the current forecast, and it's only going to cool off to 67 at night. Here's where it gets amazing. Sunday, 111 degrees for Davis. Now, that's using West Sacramento as their station point, and I've seen numbers within a degree or two or three of that. You get up into that range, it doesn't really matter, I guess, that much whether it's 111 or 113. It's going to be rather amazingly hot. And unfortunately, Sunday night is only going to get down to about 73 degrees. Labor Day, Monday, is going to also be 111 degrees and only going to cool off to 70. And then Tuesday is looking like about 105 with a cooling trend finally happening. But we're looking at 6 to 7 days of triple digit temperatures and some records. There's going to be records for the date, records for the month, possibly all-time Sacramento Valley records will fall in the area. The extended discussion Sunday through Wednesday, this anomalously strong high pressure is expected to slowly disperse. There's uncertainty in the forecast for early next week. They think a trough might push in from the Pacific Northwest Tuesday and Wednesday, which would weaken the high that's over Northern California, allow for minor cooling. But one other model shows a strong high continuing over Northern California through midweek. So these are very high temperatures, dangerously high temperatures for people. Obviously, if you're tuning into the Davis Garden Show, perhaps your question has to do with what should we do about the plants in our garden? And we'll get to that after we get through the PSAs and the other information. Daniel Swain, who writes the most detailed, evidence-based scientific blog on the subject, Weather West, which you can find at weatherwest.com, but also you can simply follow him on Twitter, describes this as a severe, dangerous, and likely record-breaking heat wave over Labor Day weekend. Steadily elevated anomalous heat. The past month has been warmer than August averages across nearly the entire state of California. There have not been really any extreme heat waves, he says, but these steadily elevated temperatures have yielded what will ultimately be another much warmer than average month in California. Wildfire activity has been, fortunately, relatively modest in recent weeks. Vegetation drying has continued at near record pace for the date due to these much warmer than average temperatures and the legacy of the severe drought nearly everywhere. This will amplify the impacts of what now appears to become quite likely a severe heat wave in the coming days. Dangerous, prolonged, and likely record-breaking heat wave peaks on Labor Day. Daytime high temperatures, he says, will be extremely high across all the inland areas, particularly the Sacramento Valley and the inland valleys of Southern California, but also elsewhere. Overnight minimum temperatures will be greatly elevated in many areas, even relative to more ordinary heat waves, especially true in the middle elevation thermal belts. The duration will be very long. In parts of Southern California, the heat is already building. and will not relent for at least 7 to 8 days. And many of them, 7 to 10 consecutive days of 100 plus degree days are likely, with some days peaking above 110 degrees. Again, weatherwest.com is the place to read the full description, or you can follow Daniel Swain, S-W-A-I-N, on Twitter.
That's hot, Don. And I'm going to stay inside where it's at least a little cooler. But yeah. What about my poor tomatoes? I can't bring those in with me.
Well, those of us who have outdoor professions will be out there doing whatever it is we have to do to keep our plants alive. You know, I own a nursery, and all the plants except for the houseplants are outside. They need water every single day, and they'll need water. Many of them will need water twice on an extremely hot day. So we'll be there, and we don't have air conditioning in our building. There's no reason for that because we're mostly outside. So what we do, by the way, and this is, we tell the staff and everybody, you should follow this, your advice yourself. Move slowly. If you feel hot, slow down, stop. Move to the shade, drink plenty of water, know the symptoms of heat stress and heat stroke. Be aware that your body is being affected by this. There's things we have to get done, but we'll do them at the pace that's appropriate and safe. And then likewise, as someone who has a farm to run and a garden, I'll be out doing the same things here, checking the irrigation, waiting for the cooler time of day if I possibly can, but getting water onto plants that need it. More to the point, your tomatoes, your peppers, your eggplants, the big three that people like to grow in their vegetable gardens are going to be very, very stressed by this, and the fruit will be affected. Already we've seen sunburn because we've had some high temperatures in the last few days. Sunburn is mostly sun scald, as some people like to call it, on the west side of the fruit, the part facing the west, the hottest sun of the day, has just burned. And I'm suggesting to people, and we have a normal high temperature for this time of year, and you've got some fruit that's getting close to ripe or even just turned color, but not all the way full color, pick it, bring it in. Remember, as we've said a few times this summer now, it'll ripen evenly and steadily on your kitchen counter, and ripening slows way down during the heat wave. Ripening of the plant's metabolism changes when it's extremely high temperature, and that ripening slows down. Spoilage organisms don't slow down. So if you have something out there that's got even a minor injury, like a little bird peck on it or some kind of mechanical injury, it's not going to ripen, but it is going to spoil. So I do strongly suggest that you simply go out either the day you're listening to the show, or especially Saturday morning would be particularly timely with the extreme heat coming Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. Pick the ones that have even started to turn color. We're talking mostly about tomatoes here. Line them out on your kitchen counter inside, where presumably your temperatures are somewhere in the 70s, maybe 80s, depending on your personal comfort levels. They'll ripen. They'll ripen over a few days. Out on the vine, ripening will slow way down, and sunburn likelihood is increasing. If you have any fruit, if there's still any peaches or plums that are, September is getting late for that, but there are a few varieties that are still out there. If they're anywhere close to ripe, I strongly suggest you pick them, because they will be damaged with a process that is sometimes called pit burn, where the extreme heat affects the flesh right around the pit, spoils it, actually damages it, and it will get almost a fermented effect. You get a spoilage, you get an off flavor. It's not particular, you won't want to eat it at that point. And so my suggestion would be, since those are, like tomatoes, technically climacteric fruit, meaning they will continue to ripen after you pick them. They've probably got as much sugar in them as they're going to get. You don't need them to get soft ripe on the tree, and there's a risk of fruit injury, not just the fruit on the outer part of the tree exposed to direct sun. We know that'll be damaged, but the fruit that's interior will likely be damaged simply because of the high temperatures that we're looking at. 105, 110 will pretty much spoil the crop. In the years I've been here, we've had temperatures like this occasionally. We're flirting with records, but I was here when those records were set. Each time I had a crop of corn, it was destroyed. I mean, the corn kernels were just, they became tough. The flavor was not good. It essentially ruined the crop. So that may happen. That's just a sad thing when it happens. You don't need to worry about squash, pumpkins, melons, for the most part. I have heard stories of watermelons bursting when you irrigate them right before extreme heat. Those are stories. I don't really know how far to go on that, because I'm more concerned about plants that are on the edge of drought stress. And this goes beyond just the vegetable garden and the fruit trees. This goes to the trees and the shrubs, but especially the trees in your landscape. The ET rate, we talk about it all the time. So hopefully longtime listeners know what we mean when we're saying ET rate, the evapotranspiration rate, the rate at which plants are using water.
2 inches, for lawn in Davis, 2 inches a week, right?
That is maximum. And yes, you can get by with a little less than that. The typical ET rate that's measured is just about 2 inches a week here from 1st of June through, let's say, the middle to late part of September. Certainly,
but not when it's over 100.
Right. The two things that increase the evapotranspiration rate are the temperature, the absolute temperature, and wind. Now, there's not any wind associated with this, so we aren't going to have drying out, but we're going to have very high temperatures. When this has happened in the past, the ET rate has gone up by anywhere from 10 to 30%. A 2-inch week will be a 2.2, 2.3-inch week. Ordinarily in the past, that wasn't a huge problem because people were overwatering. So the plants could adjust to it. There was enough extra moisture in the soil. Well, you all have done a great job of conserving water. Everybody's converted over to drip systems. Most of our conversations with people nowadays are about under-irrigating rather than over-irrigating. They're watering so little that plants are on the edge of stress. They're showing deficit irrigation, to use a technical term. And that can work, but now we're going to be challenging those plants with a significantly higher ET rate. This would be a great time, if you haven't done so already, to deep soak some of your trees, to deep soak some of your shrubs. If you have a drip system, I was just talking to a guy about this yesterday, and it's already set and running, just go out and turn it on for another couple cycles. Maybe that's the easiest way to do it. If that's complicated, another customer didn't know how to do that, all right, then take a hose, you know, go back to the 20th century, take a hose at a trickle, set it at the base of one tree at a moderate flow, move it to a few places around that tree over several hours, then move it to another tree. Set a sprinkler at the base of an important tree, like a redwood. A sprinkler can put out a surprising amount of water in a short time. One of those little spot sprinklers on the end of a hose, and you've got your hose on, let's say, a half to almost a full turn, that's putting out 100, 200 gallons in a matter of half an hour. So you can go ahead and give that tree a good soaking on the left side of the trunk, on the right side of the trunk. At least you've soaked down a foot or so into the soil and given that tree what it needs. And I used redwood as an example. They look really bad right now. They've gone through the whole summer of a profound drought, second, third year in a row of this, and many of them are looking really bad. The way to make a decision to remove a tree is not to kill it. The way to make a decision to remove a tree is to have it removed professionally and safely. Killing it makes it unsafe. So if your intent is to get rid of that tree later, stopping watering it now is not a good option. Continue to water it, keep the tree healthy, keep the trees safer, because trees become unsafe when they're drought stressed. This is an important consideration. And the trees I'm concerned about especially are the ones that perhaps we shouldn't be planting as many of, but we have a lot of. Coast redwood, birch trees, maples of all kinds. Some are more drought tolerant than others, but just figure they're on the less drought tolerant end of the spectrum. Magnolias, lindens, you know, mostly what I call East Coast trees, the trees that people plant widely in higher rainfall climates that we've done very well with here over many years. But this drought, right on the heels of the one that's, you know, was 10 years ago, is really stressing some of those species. Some of them, sure, your birch tree, if it dies, well, that's not a terribly dangerous thing to have. But a 50-foot redwood tree, and I'm seeing them dying gradually down from the top, up from the bottom, depending on where their roots are. And those are going to become somewhat unsafe. Fortunately, coast redwoods aren't, you know, massive limbs, but they're still dropping things from 30, 40 feet up in the air, and that could be dangerous. So I would give those types of trees a really good soaking. And there's, you know, the simplest way is to use your existing system if it's there, or bypass it with a hose, even with a sprinkler. You could just set an oscillating sprinkler in the backyard that overshoots, waters all the shrubs and trees, let it run for a couple of hours. Do that once. That'll water probably to a depth of about a foot. If you measure, you get an inch or two of water in a pan while you do that, great. You've probably saved the life of some of your shrubs and trees, or at least reduced the likelihood of severe heat and drought injury.
So if people are listening to this on Thursday, when we're broadcasting this, can run out and water your trees before the really bad heat starts. But if you don't hear this program until Saturday, or you listen to a podcast and it's Monday, is it okay to water during the heat wave if you forgot to do it or didn't get around to doing it beforehand?
Your trade-off is there's a risk of the pathogens that we're always concerned about attacking during extreme heat, but the tree is being badly stressed by drought. So I would err on the side of saving it from the drought. And if you can water really thoroughly, relatively quickly, and get done, and allow the surface to then dry off, as it will rather quickly, then I think you're safe. What I don't want to see is a trickle of drip running through this whole thing. You're just inviting trouble. If you run drip system close to the trunk during very high temperatures for 24 hours, that is textbook Phytophthora inoculation. That you couldn't do a better job of it, especially if it's like under mulch or under the soil or something like that. So I'd rather see, in this case, I'd rather see you putting on the water fairly quickly. The main point is get it done, do it early in the day if you possibly can, and then just turn it off and let it coast through the heat, and you'll see how things look afterwards. But we are looking at 7-8 days over 100 degrees, very high evapotranspiration rates. Your vegetable garden needs a little extra water too. So a simple way to do that, if you're still keeping your tomato vines going, as I hope you are, is give everything a little longer soaking than usual. And also wash the plants off just to clean them up, get the dust off the leaves, and get some extra moisture out there for the plants and for the beneficials.
If you go out and you pick all the tomatoes that have any hint of color on them and bring them in to keep them from being damaged, what about the ones that are like green or there are just flowers now? I mean, can your tomato vines still continue? Should we keep them? Do we pull them out? What's going on?
The fruit that you're picking in October set in mid-August. So flowers are not anything to be concerned about at this point. I don't think we really have time for a flower in early September to set fruit and give you good quality fruit, because it'll be ripening late October, early November. Yes, we all who have grown tomatoes have had that experience. Sometimes we have a dry year or it's sunny or something goes right. We're actually picking tomatoes, you know, for Thanksgiving. I don't pull the vines out, so it's a pleasant surprise when that happens. My big harvest is the one that is from the fruit that set a week or two ago. I mean, I'm getting a lot right now from fruit that set back in July, back in late June and July. But the flowers in mid-August, you'd be picking in mid to late October. Still time for that where we are here in the Sacramento Valley because of the nature of our growing season. If you're listening in places where Labor Day is when everything winds down, you know there's no point worrying about green fruit. Green fruit on the plant protects itself from extreme heat. It's got more of that waxy layer on it. It's often more sheltered inside the foliage. It hasn't poked out to get exposed. I have found that even with extreme heat waves, the green fruit is fine as long as the plant is not drought stressed. So this would be a good time if you haven't done so. If you've been keeping your vegetable garden on the edge of drought, if you've been watering as little as possible and being good about conserving your irrigation, you maybe might want to cash in a few of those credits for your virtue and go ahead and soak it really thoroughly. I'm probably going to leave my system on for 2 to 3 hours. It's a drip system. And this afternoon, Wednesday, as we're speaking, because I know that'll get some extra water down in the soil for the deeper rooted plants. Doesn't work for peppers, beans, and things like that. They're shallow rooted. So probably you'll need to run their system every day or so right on through this heat, or wash them off or hand water or whatever is appropriate. And expect a fair bit of the pepper fruit. Anything on a pepper that's any close to color will probably sunburn. So you might want to go ahead and pick those. And just for the record, peppers can also ripen indoors on the counter. Ripening in the case of peppers, meaning turn from green to red. They will, if they've started to turn to that color, they will continue to ripen and they'll get a bit sweeter as they do so. So as long as they're sitting in a place where they aren't likely to spoil, and try to spread them out when you set things on your counter to ripen so they aren't touching each other. People often learn this the hard way. If your tomatoes are all together in a basket and one of them on the bottom rots, well, it's the old one bad apple story. It'll quickly, all that rot stuff will spread quickly to the next ones as they go. So the best thing to do, you can get nursery flats is what I use because I have dozens of them around. Just space them out in the flats so they're up off the ground a little bit. A little air movement underneath them is good, or put some paper towels under them and check them each day because on the bottom they can spoil and it's best if they're not touching. If you do that, you'll probably be able to eat those tomatoes over a 2 to 3 week period as they ripen. So they'll be fine and you will have probably saved your crop this year. We don't normally do this, but we're looking at several days of extremely high temperature. And on each of these days, we'll probably be hitting 100 degrees by 11 or 12, you know, by noon, with high temperatures building as the afternoon goes along. So for you, as well as for the plant, and as well as for optimum results on this harvest process, I suggest you do it early in the day when it'll be reasonably pleasant to be out there. I just want to go ahead and mention when we have a new broadcaster at KDRT, he or she is going by the moniker of Professor A, has an extensive knowledge of prehistoric rhythms, antiquated sounds, and tectonic transformations in music. Professor, you have no idea how you've stirred my heart. I come from a family of geologists, geophysicists, and paleontologists, so you're right up my alley. So what exactly is Professor A going to be doing? Well, it's a program called Song of Dinosaurs.
Song of Dinosaurs?
That's the name. Classic rock, funk, psychedelic rock conjured up from the depths of yesteryear by Professor A. There are two episodes you can find already as you go to kdrt.org. Look for Song of Dinosaurs in the program guide. And they're only online for 2 weeks after their broadcast. But you can also go down there if you enjoy this music. Click on the RSS feed and you'll have that podcast entering your computer just the way ours does. And I love the picture on the Song of Dinosaurs homepage. So brand new show here at KDRT, Song of Dinosaurs with, let's run those again, classic rock, funk, psychedelic rock, conjured up from the depths of yesteryear.
It sounds like the 60s is what it sounds like.
Yes, it does. Could be. KDRT is community radio. That's public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. And our thanks to Nigel down in the Bay Area, who sent a donation and said, for Davis Garden Show, we love to hear from you. You can do that yourself by going to kdrt.org and clicking on the support button.
So Don sent me as plant list. It says 10 plants that draw birds into your garden. And they're not really plant species, well, some of them are, but more general broad characteristics. And the first one, of course, is big trees.
Yeah.
And that's it. I mean, if you look around in your trees, that's where you're going to see a lot of birds.
Well, let me tell you a little story, which is that we bought this farm we live on in the mid-1980s, and it was row crop. Row crop, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, level field, ditch irrigated, single crop that grows through the summer, new crop that grows through the winter in our area. So you'll have, let's say, sugar beets followed by winter wheat, and it's all irrigated at ground level. So the good news is, because they pull a ditch all the way around the farm to irrigate, water goes to every corner of the farm. That's good because the folks who we bought the place from barely planted anything other than these row crops and a handful of very large trees now that are around the houses, sycamore, walnut, things like that. Not much in between. They were farmers. They weren't gardeners. There are a couple privets and a couple fruit trees and a row of geraniums and some daffodils. That was about it. And so when we moved here, the birds that we had on our property were the ones that live in the row crops, which are ground birds. You know what those are.
Those are like quails and pheasants, and then the little songbirds in the winter, white crowned.
Chookers would be out there, which is a non-native species. We'd get turkeys out there. If it was really wet because the row crops was standing water, we'd see snowy egrets and things like that. So you get we call them, I guess, the ground birds. And then in the big trees, you'd get some really cool birds way up there. You'd get massive nests of yellow-billed magpies.
You're going to get corvids all over the place in a big tree.
Yes, and we did. We had
the magpies, the jays, the ravens, if you're in a right place. I don't think your farm is.
No, I would see them pass through. But in those days, the yellow-billed magpie was the dominant species. Unfortunately, it was decimated by West Nile virus. But they make these giant nests that are 5 or 6 feet across, where they're literally just stacking branches with no apparent thought given to whether they're going to stay stable. So any wind would blow, they'd fall apart. It was like having shrieking parrots all day long. They're very entertaining. People apparently come to the valley to see these birds, but they're much rarer than they used to be. What would always happen every summer, midsummer, is a raptor would come in. There'd be a whole day-long battle as the raptor would just move in, sit right down on their nest and not budge. Well, the magpies would fly around screaming and shrieking and trying to dive bomb it and get rid of it. And whether it was a turkey vulture or a red-tailed hawk or a giant horned owl in one instance, they would just stay put until the magpies would finally give up and fly away to find a tree where they could start their nests up again. So those are it. You had ground level birds and you had way up high birds. I don't know what you call the way up high birds, but that's what we call them, the big tree birds. We didn't have the in-between birds. So the first thing I did while we were waiting to figure out what we were going to do with this row cropland was I planted a row of sunflowers. Guess what comes into sunflowers?
Well, now, once they're seeds, you'll get seed eaters. But when they're flowers,
hummingbirds,
as you know, sunflowers, a whole bunch of tube flowers in the middle and a ring of flag flowers on the outside. Right. So that means there are hundreds of tubes. Hummingbirds love tubes.
So hummingbirds, yeah. Even though they had no apparent place to nest nearby, they found the sunflowers. And this is really a key point for drawing birds, especially hummingbirds, daisies. They're composite flowers. They used to be under the name Compositae, which was easy to remember. Now they're called Asteraceae. easy to remember because asters are classic daisies. They draw hummingbirds very effectively. And they also draw butterflies, you know, anything that's going to poke its little proboscis in there and get the nectar reward that's at the base of those little tiny flowers. People don't think of a daisy as a bunch of little tiny tubular flowers, but that is in fact what it is. And a sunflower is a classic daisy. So the very first thing we planted that drew birds onto our property with sunflowers. And the take home from this is daisies in general are really good, easy plants to grow to draw birds and butterflies and other beneficial insects, because their bloom is a particular structure that certain of those birds, like the hummingbirds, and certain of those insects, like the butterflies, and many types of bees are very attracted to. And there's probably a daisy you can grow pretty much anywhere. Sunflowers are easy, but wherever you're listening, there's probably a daisy that's easy to grow in your backyard. Well, I've been growing a plant called Madea elegans, which is a California native daisy. I've been growing it in pots just to see if it would work as a garden plant. Hummingbirds love it. They go to it. They go to the Tithonia that's nearby, which is sometimes called Mexican sunflower. They go to the zinnias that are nearby and so forth. So they're going from one daisy to another. So there's native wildflowers that you can grow, non-native garden plants. Better, I suppose, if they're more open and less doubled with all those scrunched up petals like a lot of modern garden hybrids have. But do a mix. Do whatever you want. Just get some daisies out there that are bright and colorful and will certainly draw in hummingbirds for starters, as well as a lot of other beneficial insects. So that's why sunflowers were number two on the list.
One of the things that Don doesn't know, because he's a gardener, he's not a birder, is that those big tall trees, those big trees, they have a lot more birds in them than you think they do. You see the big ones because, well, they're big. But the little ones, the ruby-crowned kinglets, the maybe some nuthatches in the winter, there's a lot of birds that are little tiny things up in the branches too far away for you to see them, but they're there.
Yeah, and a lot of trees that we did plant, a lot of trees and shrubs that we planted subsequently provided cover and density and branch structure. We noticed, for example, we did a whole row of Meta Sequoia, the Dawn Redwood, down our driveway. It has a very horizontal branching structure, and certain birds move very rapidly through that. And I don't know what they are because I can't tell, but they're not the big birds and they're not the ground birds, they're the intermediate birds. And so they just like the cover that those trees provide and the branch structure. But the next thing on the list is actually a very specific one that I put on there intentionally, because this is the kind of list people often want. I want to make a point about this. Penstemon midnight, right? It's one of always on my top 10 perennials list. Purple bloom, tubular flower, long-lived plant for an herbaceous perennial, long-lived plant for a penstemon, which are notorious typically as 2 to 3 year plants. My midnight penstemons typically last 10 to 12 years. I included it because it checks all the boxes that you'll see when someone says, "What do you have to plant for hummingbirds?" I say, "Well, you want a tubular flower and you like it to be blue or red and you want it to blah, blah, blah." Well, it meets all those criteria. It absolutely does. And you will see definitely hummingbirds going to midnight penstemons. You'll see various butterflies going to them. You'll also see the big xylocopa bees, the big carpenter bees going to them and trying to get in that flower, even though they don't fit. And I mentioned that one because it's a very specific variety, but there's lots of other penstemons that are perfectly good for this purpose as well. They may or may not be purple or red. They might be white or they might be light pink. Guess what? Hummingbirds go to them anyway. Some of them are native. That's great. They tend to have a shorter bloom season if they're native species, but that's cool if it's part of a mixed border of perennials or flowers where you're trying to just have something blooming all the time. This one has about a 3-month bloom period, which is long, and it'll continue to bloom if you deadhead it. So if you like doing that, go for it. And it's a very tough plant. So I used it as an example of a very specific variety that I can recommend highly, but giving the broader point, penstemons are great, including our native ones, including the woody ones, including many of the garden hybrids as well.
So when you're talking about the Meta Sequoias that you planted, we would consider that a corridor, a bird corridor. These are birds that they want to move from this place to across over to that other place. And instead of going out in the middle and flying across, which leaves you open to being preyed upon by those hawks. So instead of flying straight across, well, you'd go from bush to bush to tree to bush to, well, maybe there's no bush here, but oh, there's some stuff on the ground that's, I can get through that. And so those corridors are really, really appreciated. by right, the next, then it doesn't matter if they're songbirds or they're, you know, little ground feeders like the sparrows or anything. It's just, it's safe that way.
Right. And in our bare field, the first thing we did, obviously, was start planting some shrubs and some things like that. And I'll jump down on the list a little bit. One of the first things I put in was our native ceanothus, which is mountain lilac or California lilac. And I put in some Rhamnus alternus, Italian buckthorn, which is closely related to ceanothus. And without really intending it, I chose the kinds that had an outward spreading habit, they were particularly dense growth habit, and then put lower shrubs in front of them. You'd think I knew what I was doing here. Put in some, I don't know, India hawthorn or some generic shrub, and it made these steps. And I quickly realized as I was walking down my driveway, for example, that I would see birds hopping around on the ground, rush into the low shrubs that were nearby because I was walking by with a dog or something, and go up into the ceanothus and move on into the nearby tree. So it's the point of ceanothus, one, it's native, so there's great choices. They have some issues here. You got to choose your varieties carefully. They bloom in the spring with this beautiful fragrant flower that's very, very attractive to various bees and butterflies and things like that. They are followed by something most people don't notice, which is tiny fruit, little tiny fruit. They're not something we're going to eat, but I'm guessing that some of the birds enjoy that fruit.
Well, many of the songbirds will come and like that, yeah.
And people on native plant forums are often posting, oh, look, there's some sort of insect on my ceanothus. It looks like scale or it looks like aphids or something. And I'm thinking, yeah, good, fine. That's great. Just leave that there because I'm sure some of the birds will enjoy that as well. So you're providing this little ecosystem with a more important point, cover. And the cover seems to be one of the crucial things that we talk about. So that brings us to two other plants on the list. Mahonia, which is native, or the non-native types are also very good. They're scratchy. They have scratchy leaves. They've got really dense foliage. And I thought, how could a bird want that? You know, it's scratchy. Well,
oh, keeps the cats out, man.
Yeah, exactly. You should watch a small bird disappear into a Mahonia clump. They do it very fast. You know they're in there, but they're hiding. You can't see them, and nothing's going to go in after them, I guarantee it. And it's a very easy plant to grow. If you want the native version, Mahonia aquifolium is a lovely plant. And then the Mahonia lomaria folia or some of the other Asian species do very well here as well. And they all have scratchy leaves. So plant them carefully where you're not going to bump into them. They also have flowers in the winter that are bright yellow. We know that bright yellow attracts beneficial insects of various types. We know that those flowers are followed by berries, which hang on there in clusters. I've tasted them. They taste rather astringent to me, but something's eating them because they all disappear bit by bit. And that goes for the native types and the non-native types. So you're putting in a plant that is a food source as well as providing cover. The other one that I'll mention is something we started planting right away. And this always gets a little more challenging to describe. My father and mother were very active in the American Bamboo Society. I continue to edit their magazine 17 years in. I've been editing the magazine of the American Bamboo Society. So we planted bamboo in some areas of the property. Now, of course, I can see when I'm speaking to a group, I can see eyes widen, arms fold, people sitting back in their chair going, I've heard bamboo. That really runs. I have my brother-in-law knew a guy who completely took, he had to move out. This kind of thing you hear. We planted clump-forming bamboos. We planted the types that do not run. And these are very tight clumps. They're tall. They're big plants, anywhere from 10 to 30 or 40 feet tall. So this is not something for a small yard. But the rhizomes that they spread by spread a half inch or an inch each season, not 5 to 7 feet as running bamboos are capable of doing. And bamboo doesn't flower. It flowers on cycles of 30 to 120 years or more. So it's not pollen. It's not providing anything for those beneficial insects. It's not really got anything that things eat except it's extremely dense, especially the clump-forming ones. And within a couple of years of planting giant timber bamboo and other clump-forming bamboos, we realized the hummingbirds were nesting in the bamboo because of the density and the twigginess. There's usually a few little things living on bamboo, scale insects or mealybugs or whatnot that could provide a food source, I suppose. But they also provide something even more important than cover. They provide moisture directly. They not only do they make their own mulch, their own leaf litter, their own culm sheath litter, the stuff that builds up at the base of the bamboo clump and can get 6 to 12 inches deep. And if you're watering it, that creates a whole habitat for all kinds of cool beetles and things like that. They also trap water vapor in the form of fog or any kind of mist. They trap it and condense it. If we reach the dew point, which doesn't happen here very much between about June and September, but when we reach the dew point, which is the temperature below which water vapor condenses out of the air onto its leaf surfaces. They have huge amount of leaf surface. They're very, very, very leafy plants. And so you look at a bamboo first thing in the morning, it's covered with dew if we've reached the dew point. And rather importantly, they do one other thing that a lot of grasses do, which is called guttation, which is where they exude moisture at the edges of their leaves, little droplets of moisture from inside the plant. So it doesn't matter what the humidity is, it doesn't matter what the rainfall is, they're actually putting water out onto their leaf surface, which is an important water source for beneficial insects. And of course, all that density just traps moisture and humidity right around the plant. So they're a great place to inhabit, whether you're a bird, a beneficial insect, or what. So bamboo can be very useful in the landscape in providing a couple of the key things that birds need. We've talked about nesting sites, we've talked about food sources, we've talked about moisture, cover, habitat.
One of the things that is very useful if you really are interested in hummingbirds is having some viney stuff.
Yeah.
Stuff with vines, because especially the smaller vines, because they're small enough that a hummingbird can actually get around it, get in it, get on it. And it makes a lovely place to put a little nest. Understand, hummingbird nests are about the size of a quarter.
Yeah.
Well, we don't need a giant branch for that. In fact, we don't want to be on a giant branch for that, because if it's a giant branch, then other things can be on the branch. But if it's a little tiny branch, it's just right for a hummingbird.
I want to move on from bamboo to something that is also sort of counterintuitive in this regard, which is roses. One of the very first things I planted on the property was a Lady Banks rose. Lois and I both have experience with this plant. I'm not talking about a rose garden like my grandfather's rose garden, where they were pruned within an inch of their life and they sprayed them with who knows what, and he was growing perfect long stem roses on a relatively open plant. I'm talking about species roses, 19th century heirloom roses, many of the what we call climbers, which are really just really big shrubs, found roses, which are the roses that are growing around cemeteries and old cottages and old downtown areas. And the new category for the industry, relatively new, called landscape or shrub roses. These are all roses that you plant, just let them go. You know, let them grow wherever they want. My Lady Banks rose that I planted in the 1980s is 45 feet down a fence and 30 feet up into a pecan tree that I don't care about. And when it blooms for that 10-day period in the spring, it's overwhelming. It's a massive amount of bloom. What it really is, as a virtually evergreen, actually truly evergreen rose in our climate, and thornless, thank goodness, is a massive amount of cover. It's a whole lot of vegetative stuff. I've had foxes living under that and nesting under that Lady Banks rose. Feral cats have lived there at times, and there are always, always birds in there because roses have bugs on them. You know, don't spray. Don't spray your roses for their bugs, and there will be things that will come along and eat them. There's cover, there's density. I also have one that's very thorny right nearby, which I regret having planted, but it's covering about a 30-foot area, very active with wildlife because it is extremely thorny and dense and overgrown. So while they're providing some food, the main thing that roses are providing is cover. Not your normal grid pattern, highly pruned rose garden, informal roses, where you take a climbing rose and just let it sprawl in any direction it wants to, and you prune very lightly. And that gets me to one other real important point. Evergreen shrubs are a really important part of providing cover for birds. We all know that, whether it's xylosma or the ceanothus that I mentioned earlier, you know, these are broadleaf evergreen plants. I'm using the term carefully because we distinguish them from conifers or needle-like evergreens. May have their place as well, but mostly we're talking here about broadleaf evergreens. If you keep clipping those, if you keep shearing them all the time, like a boxwood hedge, or as is often done with xylosma, you'll gradually end up with this shell of foliage around an open, thinned out plant. And in fact, the longevity of that hedge will be compromised by the way you're pruning it. If you prune more naturally, just a couple cuts for size control, a little clipping to bring it in, not only does that give more interior density to the plant and better places for various animals to move and hide and make nests and feel cover, it's not as extreme a thing to do. If you've ever gone over a hedge with a power hedge shear and had a wasp nest come boiling out at you because you just cut right through it, I have. It's a very disturbing thing to do to wildlife that's in there. Whereas if I was carefully pruning a branch at a time and clipping here and clipping there and a much more healthy approach to that plant's growth habit, you'll leave the wildlife more or less intact. And if you do it just at certain seasons, very lightly, you're just not going to be creating this unacceptable habitat where it's just a ring of foliage on the outer part of the plant. You're going to having a more natural habitat and a better looking plant, in my opinion, for the landscape as well. Choose your plants according to the size you can tolerate. Don't put a giant photinia in where you're going to have to prune it all the time, but put in something where you'll just prune it with the clippers in your back pocket, not a gas-powered hedge shear. And my guess is you'll get better wildlife activity in there as well.
Xylosma is an interesting one. As you know, my yard is on two sides completely covered or bordered by xylosma bushes. Mm-hmm. And they, as they get big, and I had the ones in front, I think were probably about 20 feet tall when I took them down to 8 feet. Mm-hmm. But a xylosma normally shades out itself. So it has in the interior all the big branches and all the medium-sized branches. And then when it gets to the outside edge, well, then you've got more twigs and all the leaves. But the inside, as you say, is sort of an empty hollowness. That is one of the best bird corridors I have ever found. Yeah. They loved it. They could get from the front yard, 100 feet back in a couple of seconds because they could go right through these xylosmas. But the xylosma has a really nice feature in that when I cut it down from 20 to 8, I should explain. It had gotten up, the Lady Banks rose was in my neighbor's trees, new neighbors. We just had to, control my yard, which was expanding into theirs. So I said, okay, I don't want to be pruning anymore. So when the people came to take out the tree and all that stuff, I said, just cut it all up at 8 feet.
Yep.
Well, what I ended up with was a stump. There were no interior branches below 8 feet because the xylosma is so old. And I just sort of panicked, but it resprouted.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Because even though that wood had not seen sunlight for at least 15 years, it still had buds in it. And so it regrew itself. And I have a lovely 10-foot tall hedge.
But if you have to do a severe pruning like that for one reason or another, it's important to find out whether that is a species of plant which has lots of dormant growth buds ready to go, and xylosma, pittosporum, things like that do, or whether you're going to just have a lot of dieback like a juniper or unfortunately ceanothus. So some things can take to a hard pruning and some can't, but I'd rather have you doing an intermittent hard pruning than the constant shearing that leads to that shell of foliage. So try to prune more naturally. Do size control pruning from the start, obviously, is better, but there's some that you can do what Lois did and go in and cut them back hard. Probably very upset some birds that year, but it came back pretty quickly, I'd imagine. The density is there. So there are lots of shrubs. I mean, xylosma, one other advantage, it draws bees like crazy when it's in bloom. It used to be that was a thing that was an unselling point because a lot of people didn't want bees in their garden for one reason or another. Over the years, people have gotten concerned about the state of both our non-native European honeybee and our native bees. And now they want things that bloom and attract bees. Well, you know what? Xylosma does, even though most people don't really notice it when it's in bloom. You get up close, there are so many bees on it, you can hear them. I mean, it's very, very active. So I do look for certain characteristics of shrubs and I'm choosing them. And they don't have to have all of these characteristics, but it's best if they have at least one of them. So something that blooms over a long season. I'll put Grevillea, which is on the list that I gave to Lois. Australian shrubs, 500 species and cultivars in Australia, several dozen of which are sold in California and a couple dozen of which do very well here in the valley. They bloom all the time. They're extremely attractive to hummingbirds. Many of them are very prickly. The foxes on my property moved from the Lady Banks rose out to a Grevillea hedge once it was fully established because they feel very safe down in there under that prickly foliage. And it's always in bloom. It's a very, very active hummingbird part of my garden. I look for plants with flowers that provide nectar for bees, butterflies, hummingbirds. I've got Texas Ranger in an unirrigated planting along my county road, and it goes in these cycles of bloom. When there are so many bees on it, again, you can hear it when you get within a few feet of it. Flowers that provide some exposed pollen for smaller insects. Willows are a good example. There are anything with a catkin like that. The pollen is right out there. There are many insects that feed on pollen. Fruit for someone to eat. Sometimes it's fruit I'm planted for me to eat, like persimmons. I'm happy to share them with the cedar waxwings. Sometimes it's fruit that I'm not eating, like the Italian buckthorn or the ceanothus, but I know it's on there and drawing these birds. A mix of foliar textures and branching habits, and this is just my assumption that that makes it easier or happier for them to move through in that pass-through method that you were describing, where they're jumping up here and going there and hopping through there and so forth. So if it's all one thing, maybe not so good as having some diversity of foliage and branching types in there. I think it's obviously important that we select for drought tolerance. That's very, very important, but it's also important that we select for tolerance of heavy soils and late season rains. So a lot of our California natives here in the valley can be problematic in that regard, as can some of the grevilleas, but many other plants can take both drought and irrigation or late season rainfall. And if you have higher water plants, you can't live without your hydrangeas, okay, put them near the house to cool the windows. Higher water zone should be near your house so you can take advantage of that cooling effect. And I can tell you from experience with the holly and the nandina and the mahonia and then the ferns and the birch tree I have nearby and the Japanese maples. Yeah, I have all those kinds of things on one irrigation zone. Birds really like that. They really like that area because I got little micro sprinklers in there that spray water out. And I look out there and I'm obviously providing something for them to enjoy and various other animals as well. So all the things we've said about birds apply also to some degree to possums, skunks, foxes, feral cats, and some other forms of wildlife you may not be anxious to have.
Amphibians.
Yep.
Those things that look like snakes, but they got legs.
We call those... We call those lizards.
No.
Oh, you don't mean lizards?
this was it's a long story. I won't go into it.
Yeah.
But one of the things that you're leading up to is that birds are attracted to places where they can get a drink.
Yeah.
And so you can set up a bird bath outside your kitchen window and keep it filled and watch all the birds taking, you know, baths and drinking and fluttering and all that stuff. But you can also do something where you have a shallow, I don't know, maybe an abalone shell that you found in the garage, and you put it out next to something that has a little sprayer on it, so that when the water is turned on and that waters for the week, there's a little bit of water that goes and sits in that shell. Now, it doesn't last the whole week.
Right.
That's okay, because you don't want it to last the whole week because you don't want to get mosquitoes. But it's enough that the little birds can sneak under there and they can get their drink without having to go out into the open.
And my observation is that the birds will find the water where I put it. If there's a leak, yes, in a drip system in the orchard and I've let it puddle, I often do that. And I go out there and I find all kinds of footprints of different birds and mammals out there because I provided some water during a drought. Beneficial insects, which were, you know, a real important part of what we're also talking about with all this habitat and cover and food sources and so forth, that moisture is a little more challenging. And so having some grasses of any kind, I've mentioned bamboo, but other grasses will also do that guttation thing and also trap moisture by the nature of their foliage. So in dry winters, I'm out on my farm, I'll find ladybird beetles out in the grasses and the mustard, just the areas that haven't been mowed yet. And when it's a sunny day, they come up onto the top, onto stumps and things nearby. They're getting moisture, they're getting food, and they're coming up for the warmth. And it's important, you know, just taking one example, the leatherwing beetle, which eats aphids voraciously. If you have leatherwing beetles on your property, you're not going to have a problem with aphids. They're just going to take care of them. They have a long larval stage, the interface of decaying moist leaves and soil. And that's something like 12 to 16 months that they need to be between moist decaying leaves and your garden soil. That's easy to provide. You know, we'll tell you all the time on the garden show to rake your leaves up and pile them over there in that part of your garden. As long as there's some moisture, somehow a drip system nearby, hand watering them if you have to, you'll be encouraging this particular highly beneficial insect. But Lois has also mentioned a couple other ways to do it. And those things can be watered right off of an existing drip line. You can simply run a dripper over to a shallow bird bath that's at ground level or something like that, that holds a half inch of water. A half inch of water won't last more than a few days in our climate. So you won't get mosquito wrigglers. You won't get problems with that, but you'll be providing moisture intermittently. And just make sure your irrigation system is keeping some areas moist for these beneficial insects. One of the simplest things I've done is a very small water feature pond using a stock pond that I've, or a tank, excuse me, that I bought at our local feed store. It's got a papyrus in it and I keep it filled with water and it looks great. And I have loads of dragonflies as a consequence. I have one near a giant clump of bamboo, and one of the bamboo culms, that's what we call the shoot when it's expanded fully and has leaves, fell over right over the stock pond. And I was going to cut it off, except that I looked over and there was a dragonfly sitting on it. So I thought, okay, buddy, you get this for now at least. And it's hanging right over the water. And you see them over there all the time. So there's water for them to, their larvae develop in water. There's places for them to raise a family. There's places nearby for moisture. You don't have to go onto a full-on pond or something like that, but providing some consistent moisture, it can be really important, not just for birds, but for all these beneficial insects that really help us a lot in the garden.
Well, Don Shore and I have been doing this program for a long time, and he occasionally talks about birds. Yeah, right. I occasionally talk about plants. Yeah, right. I started a new program. It's a video program called Birding with Lois, and Don came and was on my show. So if what we just talked about piques your interest, feel free to come on over to my website, birdingwithlois.global, and you can see what Don's talking about because we have pictures as well as sound.
Birdingwithlois.global.
Yep, that's the website name, because we're intending for eventually to have a global audience. We have a global crew already. We have people from the UK and Africa helping us.
Okay, so birdingwithlois.global. In that particular episode, I talked about plants, and she told me what kind of birds I was seeing in them.
Actually, we talked, Don, we should do that again.
We talked a little bit about the history, as we have here on the, you know, of this property. When we bought it, it was just a farm field, and the kinds of birds we had and how different birds came in. So hopefully, you know, we're talking acres, but you can scale it down to your backyard, what you can do to get more birds. And as usual, I didn't just talk about birds. I want you to get things for beneficial insects and other organisms. I have to tell you, a customer came in to ask if we had some way to get rid of lizards in his yard. Hey, did we have some pellets that would get rid of lizards?
No, water.
And we all looked at him, and we all wanted to say, you know, when you're in retail, you want to just answer the question. And so ultimately we just answered the question, which was, no, we don't have anything with which to get rid of lizards. What we wanted to say was, why are you trying to get rid of lizards? They're good. They're beneficial. They don't bite. Well, I mean, some do, but most of them don't. They aren't venomous, I don't think. I mean, they're just cool animals to have in your yard. Why would you not want them there? But we didn't say that because we're in retail. And so we don't question people's motives when they ask for things that we consider irrational. We finally concluded our best guess was that he has a significant other who doesn't like lizards, because he seemed a little uncomfortable with the idea too. Well, we can talk to you about how to draw lizards into your garden. That's easy. Sun and rock walls and, okay, never mind. Gardeningwithlois.global.
How do you make raisins? Do you need a dehydrator to do it?
Well, that's not how they do it in the state of California. 98% of the raisins you buy in the grocery store are grown in Fresno area, down in Fresno County here in California. And all they do is they clip them off of the vine. They're usually Thompson seedless grapes, although some other varieties are grown for this purpose, maybe others now. That was my information a decade or more ago. They carefully strip them, the grapes themselves, off of the stems, and they put them on essentially wax paper that lies between the rows of vines right out in the sun. If you've ever been to Fresno in the summer, you know that
it's hot
really well. It's also very dry. And we're talking about August to September when they do this. And I've seen pictures of these operations. It looks like basically wax paper, well, heavy duty craft paper, I guess is the term I'm looking for. It runs down between the rows. They just lay them out on there so they're not touching too much, and they dry within 10 to 14 days. And as long as there's no rain or anything like that, which frankly in the Fresno area in late August, September is a pretty uncommon phenomenon, they just dry them right out in the field. And you can do the same thing yourself. The next question the customer asked was, how do they keep the critters off of them? And well, you probably don't want to know.
Well, when it was growing, it was out in the open air. Yeah. So it's like
How do you keep the critters off of them then?
Yeah, the critters are basically birds and rodents of various kinds, and they use whatever it is they use for those. But it, you know, it really does work to dehydrate things right out in the sun here. We've done it many, many, many times. It, for many things, 24 to 48 hours is all it takes. In the case of raisins, it takes a bit longer because of the tougher skin. There was one year, I remember about 30 years ago, I remember 98% or something like that of America's raisins come from this one area in California, and they got an inch of rain. One year around Labor Day, and it was a torrential. It was one of those, you know, Gulf of Mexico storms that came up. The entire raisin crop for the United States was ruined. Wow. There was a desperate raisin shortage that year. We just had to wait till next year. So
a related question.
Yes.
What's a currant?
A currant. Oh.
See, this is my annoyance, because people have little tiny raisins and they call them currants. No. There is a real plant called a currant, and you dry the currant berries and then you have currants. But no, people didn't want to do that, so they just made little raisins.
Well, the little raisins, you can produce a lot more readily than you can commercially produce currants. A true currant is in the genus Ribes, and they can be grown in milder climates. People ask me all the time if they'll grow here. And my answer is I've tried three times now. The plant just does not take the heat. It gets spider mites. It just doesn't grow well. So no, I don't think currants are a good thing for us. They're fine up in Oregon and places like that. Those are the European style currants in the genus Ribes. Zante currants, which is the real official name for those little grapes, are a particular grape variety that is grown. It's just a little raisin. That is all it is. And it's used in baking as a substitute for true currants. Now, it doesn't have the same flavor, but they're pretty intensely flavored, and they're great for scones and things like that. So it's a matter of a common name being applied to two totally unrelated plants.
Gee, that happens all the time.
Yeah, what's a citron? Do you know what citron is?
I think that is the chemical released by something to keep the flies away.
Citron. There was a great argument at the Thanksgiving dinner table once between my father, the scientist, and my grandfather, the engineer, about what citron was. Citron is the chewy thing that's in fruitcake. Okay, there's lots of dried fruit in fruitcake, but the basic, most important part is citron. And my father, one of them was saying, well, that's dried citrus peel. It's a particular type of citrus, thick peel that's candied, not dried, it's candied. And the other was saying, no, citron is made from a melon. It's made from the rind of a particular melon. And they went back and forth, and they liked each other, so they were polite. But this was an argument of fact. Arguments of fact in the old days, you didn't have your phone to answer the question. You didn't have a computer nearby. And the whole family sitting there watching my father and his father-in-law have this debate about a matter of fact. So finally, they pointed at the eldest child, not me. I was the youngest child. Eldest child, and said, all right, go to the encyclopedia upstairs and come back and tell us what the answer is. And Sandy goes off and upstairs. And a couple minutes later, he comes down with a great big grin. You're both right. Okay, citron, true citron, if you wish to be my grandfather.
Original citron.
Is the peel of a particular citrus, one of the more primitive citrus. It's thought to be one of the, you know, progenitors of many of the citrus that came along later. It's a very thick peel. And yes, they take it and they candy it, which you can read all about how to do that. But they essentially infuse it with sugar solution and then dry it. And that's the basic ingredient in a fancy fruitcake. But that's really expensive to do. And it's really hard to get citron. There's a melon from Northern Africa, which has a very thick peel with a very similar texture to this citrus fruit. And so they use the peel of that particular melon and they candy that. And honestly, chewing the two, once you get them into the fruitcake, you're probably not going to know the difference. But citron applies to both a citrus fruit and a melon. And we were all happy and gave thanks. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7. in Davis, California.